Welcome to the Retro Nostalgia Podcast with Matthew Ramirez, your go-to education and entertainment source for all things 80s and retro video games. In this podcast, you'll learn little-known facts on a variety of nostalgic topics, leaving you longing for the awesomeness of yesteryear. If you're ready for a blast from the past, a tubular new episode is starting now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Retro Nostalgia Podcast, your go-to podcast for all things 80s and retro video games. As always, I'm Matthew, and I'm your host. And today, I just wanted to go ahead and kind of take a look at how the video game industry was in the early 80s. Now, to all of you out there who are gamers or may know someone that plays games, we just recently had a couple of new systems actually be released, the PS5 and the Xbox One Series X. Now, these systems have caused quite a commotion in the recent weeks since they've been released. I know they've been sold out. There's been a lot of trouble for people trying to get them secondhand with scalpers online and even on sites like Craigslist and Letgo, those type of sites that these scalpers were able to get the game systems and unfortunately now are wanting exuberant prices for the systems. I think that just goes to show, though, that there's a reason these systems are being sold that for that price. The market is there. These people that want these systems are willing to pay these extreme prices, in some cases $1,500 to $2,000 for a video game system. And I think it speaks to just how big the video game industry has become nowadays. It's a pretty much a billion-dollar industry in regard to the everything, accessories, consoles, video games. Some of these games take 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years. For those of you that are GTA fans out there, the last GTA, GTA 5, was released in 2012. Those fans are still waiting for the next GTA, GTA 6, and who knows when that's going to be released, right? Nowadays, so much money gets put into these video games, so much development time. It's almost like they're full-fledged movies now with the money and time that goes into them. But I want to go back to a simpler time, a time when video games were more of a fad than a billion-dollar industry. And when things look like maybe the video game industry wouldn't be around for very long in the first place. And I'm talking about the video game crash of 1983. So, like I said, when most people today think about video games, they think of the Call of Duties, the yearly sports games, PS4, Xbox One, the Switch. But back in the 80s, it was very different. Back then, there was only one real dominant company, and that dominant company was Atari. So I just want to go ahead and kind of set the scene here for everyone of how things looked back then. Atari, they released their Atari 2600 in 1977 for $199. Now, that might not seem like a lot by today's standards, considering what I said earlier about how much people are willing to pay for the PS5 and the Xbox One Series X. But keep in mind, with inflation, this was about $840 back then. So that was definitely a major investment at the time. The system, the Atari 2600, was released on the success of Pong systems that had been released earlier in the 70s. So when I say Pong systems, the video game Pong got very popular in the early to mid 70s. And what ended up happening is companies wanted to get more money. So they were able to kind of translate the arcade game into the home market by making a standalone system with just that one game installed. So it was almost like nowadays where, you know, you have a hard drive, you're able to download games and the games are just installed in your system now, as long as you bought them. Back then, this was even before cartridges. So with this Pong, these Pong type systems, the only game they really had was Pong or different variations of Pong. But they were very popular for what they were. And Atari, they found that there could be a market for something more than just a system that played one game. And so they were able to do it with the Atari 2600. So with the Atari 2600, this was the first one of the first systems that allowed for interchangeable ROMs to be played, meaning that users could simply change cartridges when they wanted to play a different game. So this was a game changer back then, right? They're coming off of, you know, coming home, if they were lucky enough to have a Pong system, which again, it must have cost at least $100, $150 in that time, which if we equate it to today's time, is probably close to $600, $700. And all they could do was play that one game. All of a sudden now with the Atari 2600, people were able to play multiple games on the same system. And that led to many, many people that were buying the system because it just allowed for unlimited adventures, unlimited games on one system. So the success of the Atari 2600 led to other companies who wanted in. Of course, like in any other successful industry, you usually get those companies that want to get some of the money too and be a part of it. So Mattel soon followed with their Intellivision in 1980. Then we had the Magnavox that released their Odyssey 2, which was actually a couple years sooner in 1978. We had a couple other consoles. Another console, the Astrocade, was also released in 1978. And pretty much that's the first problem here, going back to our initial focus of the game crash of 1983. There was a couple of problems that led to that. And me discussing these systems, I don't know if you guys counted how many there were, but this was an issue. All of a sudden, I just counted off four systems that were out by 1980. Now, keep in mind, this started with the Atari 2600 in 1977. So in the span of 3 years, we had another three consoles come out, right? So there was simply too many consoles at the time, which led to an oversaturation. And again, remember that back then the prices were much higher than they first appeared to be due to inflation, right? So if a system was released again for like Atari's $199, that's equivalent to $840 nowadays. So people really had to make a big investment in this financially and with their time, because if they're buying it, they would have to have the time to play it. Now, at that time, it was mainly parents buying these systems for their kids. So that was another obstacle. The parents really didn't necessarily see the value in the video game system. It was always the children, the kids that were telling them, you know, I want this for Christmas. I like the games. They're fun to me. And the parents would be the ones that would have to make the investment themselves. So again, not a cheap investment at that. And that was just for the system itself. Then you had the games, which cost around $35 to $40 at the time, or adjusted for inflation, around $94 to $107 per game. By 1982, the year right before the crash, there were three more consoles in the picture. So remember, I already counted off four. And then adding on to those four, Atari had released their follow-up console, the 5200, in 1982. Coleco, a separate company, released their ColecoVision in March of 1982 as well. So then you have two more consoles adding to the original four that I discussed, and that brings the number to six. Then finally, a console that's not really much known, it's called the Vectrex, was also released in 1982. So keep in mind, like I said, you start in 1977, you got the Atari 2600, you know, things start going well for them. It's not flying off the shelves, but it's selling enough of a profit. And keep in mind, because the video game industry was so small at the time, there weren't really any other players. So Atari was getting all that money to themselves. But skip ahead just 5 years later, And now we have 7 systems out concurrently. That's wild. I don't really remember any time, at least recently, that we've had 7 systems from different companies out at the same time. I know this kind of happened later on again during the early 90s when we had a plethora of 16-bit systems, some of the 8-bit systems still out, and then we had like a slow transition into the 32-bit era. But for an industry that was just starting out to already have 7 systems out in such a short amount of time, you can see why there was an oversaturation. And people, it's not like, again, they were selling off the shelves. They were being bought at a slow pace. So the demand really wasn't there, and the supply was just too much at the time. And that kind of sounds insane nowadays, because it's the opposite now with most people not able to get a PS5 or an Xbox One. But that was, you know, a different time. Then there was a second issue. And the second issue was third-party companies. Now, while third-party companies are commonplace and have provided games such as Call of Duty and Minecraft, back then there was no third-party companies. Back then, it was really just Atari making all the games, getting all the profit for the games. So they were really the only ones involved in the cycle of system to market, to games to market, and then getting the money from both. But in 1979, there was a group of disgruntled Atari employees that left to create the first third-party software company, which many of you would know now as Activision. Now, what happened was these workers, they felt like they deserved to get credit for the creations that they were making, which was the video games. And Atari didn't want to give them that credit. So they ended up splitting off and forming their own game company. And since they had already had time to work with the Atari system, knew the ins and outs of that machine, they were easily able to create games for the system. So Atari didn't really take to that. They didn't like it, because all of a sudden, it would set a bad precedent that anyone could release a game on their console and pretty much get the profits of that game, and Atari would be left with nothing. So Atari tried to sue, but eventually it would have to settle out of court, as they were not going to win the legal battle. It was just dragging on, and the courts were going in favor of Activision. So this settlement occurred in 1982. Now, if you guys remember when I was talking earlier and I was talking about how many systems there were by a certain year, that year would happen to be 1982. So there's a reason the next year is when the game crash happened. You're seeing all these events unfold in that year right before the game crash. So what the settlement allowed or opened up, it was all of a sudden other companies decided to get a piece of the video game pie and started releasing games. The floodgates were open. And what this led to was an oversaturation of video games now. So like I said before, there was an oversaturation of video game consoles. All of a sudden, there was an oversaturation of video games themselves. Before the settlement, where Activision was allowed to create games and it opened the doors for other companies, there were only 17 third-party companies at the summer CES. Now, for those of you that might not know what CES is, it's a consumer electronics show. And there's usually 2 shows. There's one summer in the summer, one in the winter. So in 1982, there was only 17 third-party companies at the summer CES. And that's where, before video game conventions were around, that's where video games would be shown to the press and to the other people in the video game industry. Going ahead a year, 1983, there was an estimated 100 companies creating video games. So just think about that. You're going from 1 year before 1982, 17 companies making video games. All of a sudden you had 100 companies. That's, you know, just boggles the mind just how many companies wanted to get into the industry and get the money, all because of that one settlement. Now, again, I'm not saying third-party companies are a bad thing. Obviously, there's many third-party companies now, and some of them have become very, very popular and famous. We're talking about companies like Capcom, companies like 2K, Konami, that, you know, made a business of being a third-party company and creating video games that were classics. But here's the problem back then. There was no quality control of these video games. Because the market was still so new, at that point only 5-6 years old, there was no idea of how to control the business or how to make it so that the business could have growth overall, not just for one company, but for all companies or the video game industry as a whole. There was no precedent. And since there was no quality control, a lot of these games ended up being pretty bad. There was just no people saying yes or no to the games, what can be released on the system, what couldn't be released on the system. And it just led to any company, okay, I'm going to make X game for this Y system, and I'm going to do it now, and I'm going to release it. It was pretty much the wild, wild west of the video game industry back then. The low quality of many of these games led to a loss of consumer confidence. Again, at this time, it's the parents buying these games for their kids. And, you know, as a parent, you want the kid to, okay, you spent $40 on this game for a $200 system. You expect the kid, your child, to have fun with it and play it for a good while. And then, okay, eventually maybe they move on to another one. But that's not what happened, because a lot of these games, and because of their poor quality, these kids wanted to get to another game, or they wanted to return it, and they or never even played it. And the parents were not into that. They were like, look, I just spent $40 on this game when I'm only making, you know, X amount of money, and you don't like it? So that's where the loss in consumer confidence came from. All of a sudden, the parents were, well, why am I going to buy a game if my kid's not going to like it, if it's not good? Where is the investment in that? So that was kind of the second domino to fall in this. Now, keep in mind, I'm talking so around late 1982. You know, it's not necessarily the crash yet, but the hints are there. Stuff's happening, and it's not looking too good. And then we get to the final kind of nail in the coffin. Now, for those of you that were around back then, there was a certain movie that came out earlier in 1982. And it was very popular. It made lots of money at the box office. And everyone wanted to release merchandise because there was a lot of money to be made in merchandise for that movie. And that movie was E.T. E.T., which is a classic movie, was a phenomenon back then. People couldn't get enough of the movie. It made, like I said, a lot of money at the box office. It was actually the highest grossing movie at the box office in 1982 of all time. And it took another Spielberg movie, Jurassic Park, 11 years later to dethrone E.T. as the highest grossing movie of all time. That's how popular this movie was. And, you know, what would make more sense than, okay, this is the highest grossing movie. What's another industry that's growing at a popular rate? Video game industry. Let's make a video game of it. You know, it makes perfect sense, right? And what's the most popular brand at the time? Atari. Atari, of course, they're going to have to make an E.T. game, right? So they ended up releasing an E.T. game in December of 1982, right in time for the holiday season. But things didn't go according to plan. There was a huge backlash by customers who found that the game was very bad, very boring, and not accessible at all by the demographic, which was, you know, maybe 5 to 12 year olds that had watched the movie and wanted to feel like they were a part of the movie. And this led to many returns of the game and requests of refund from parents who had purchased the game for their children. Now, back then, the way these cartridges worked is that these game companies would have to put an order in ahead of time, ahead of the launch date, of how many copies of the game they wanted to be ordered and made, manufactured, so then they can then release it to the consumer, to the public. So Atari had ordered 4 million copies in anticipation of the holiday season. They expected it to be a big seller. And they weren't wrong, but the problem was that most of them were returned. Out of those 4 million copies, 3.5 million were returned to Atari. And each one being a $40 cartridge, $40 price point, you can imagine Atari lost millions on this. And it was not actually their first debacle in video gaming. They had a prior debacle earlier in the year with another video game that was a disappointment. And that was the translation of a popular video game you guys may know as Pac-Man. Pac-Man, just like E.T., was a phenomenon back then. That was actually released sooner than 1982. It was released in 1980 in the arcades. And it had taken a while to get translated to the Atari system. But once news got around that it was going to be released, there was much anticipation for it. People were hyped up for it, mainly the kids and those teens that were spending time at the arcade. They were excited, looking forward to being able to play Pac-Man in their homes. But it ended up being a disappointment, just like E.T. The game looked nothing like its arcade counterpart, and many of the copies of the Pac-Man game went unsold. And again, in that time, Atari had to order the cartridges ahead of time, and they bet their hedges on it, and it was a failure once again. They ordered 12 million copies of the game. 12 million. They were expecting every single Atari system owner to buy the game, and they only sold 7 million. That might seem like a lot, but you gotta keep in mind, they ordered 12 million, 5 million copies went unsold. And these cartridges weren't cheap to order. So for each cartridge that they ordered, they were at least paying $4 to $5 for each cartridge to be made. So now you combine that Pac-Man debacle, you have the E.T. video game debacle. Atari, by the end of 1982, had lost millions of dollars. And worse, all the consumer confidence in them was gone. And that's when we get into what we now know as the game crash of 1983. Following that holiday season, the video game bubble burst, and many companies went bankrupt. Remember those companies that said that we're making video games for all these systems now, when we went from 17 third-party companies to 100 third-party companies? Yep, all those, gone. Shuttered doors. There was no money to be made. All the people had been burned, the customer had been burned, and they were disgusted by the video game market at the time, fed up with it, and they didn't want to deal with it. And they let their wallets talk. Companies that had consoles out, like Mattel and Magnavox, they left the game and market entirely. So that Odyssey 2, gone. That Intellivision, gone. Were there any more follow-ups? Nope. Mattel and Magnavox didn't even want to deal with the video game market anymore. That's the type of bad taste that left in their mouths. Retail stores had to slash prices down since they couldn't even send the games back, because all those companies, like I said, went bankrupt. There was no company to send the games back to. So the stores were stuck with them. They had to slash the games down. Games that were $35, $40 all of a sudden were in a $5 bin. $5 clearance bin. Atari itself, they were a shell of their former selves. They lost $356 million by mid-1983. All those cartridges that were returned to them, they didn't know what to do with them, so they buried them in the middle of the New Mexico desert. And yes, that rumor is true. There was a project a couple years ago, I want to say in 2014, that a couple of people underwent to a journey to travel to New Mexico, and they wanted to dig at the site where the video games were rumored to be buried, and they found the cartridges. They actually found the ET cartridges that had been buried in the desert. But they didn't only find ET cartridges. They found Pac-Man cartridges. They found Space Invaders cartridges, Miss Pac-Man cartridges. This was a combination of all the extra cartridges that Atari had been unable to sell or had been returned to them. And they just decided to bury them in the middle of the desert. So that gives you an idea of how bad things got. Atari, they had to be restructured to survive. Its systems, the 2600 and 5200, were phased out by early 1984. And all of a sudden, from the height, that was 81, 82, everything was going well. Systems were selling out. Systems were being manufactured left and right field. By 1984, all that was gone in the U.S. It was down. The video game industry was down to a whimper here. And there were many lessons to be learned from this video game crash. Again, at the time, video games were literally in their infancy. There had never been a video game market. There had never been a video game console as popular as the Atari. People didn't know how to go about the business or know what they could do to make sure nothing like this would happen to the industry as a whole. Again, lessons were learned, and the video game industry was later able to go through a revival. And it was actually by a Japanese company, which I'm sure much of you or all of you know very well, and that's the Nintendo company. Nintendo, they were the ones that were able to revive the industry later on, and that's just a whole other topic for another episode. But you know, that crash wasn't for nothing, and it's an important footnote to remember. You know, the video game crash was an event that happened. A lot of those, most of those, or all of those companies are gone now. I'm talking about the video game makers like Atari, Coleco, Mattel, Magnavox. You don't see any of those companies making systems nowadays. You still have Activision around, and they were able to survive because as a third-party company, they weren't tied to one system. And they were able to manufacture games for the PC market, which kind of took off a little bit there in the mid-80s, and that's where Activision was able to make some of their money and survive. But as far as those game console manufacturers, they were pretty much done. Now, one thing I want to point out here about the video game crash here coming to an end is that the video game crash, as we know it, in 1983, was actually only an American thing. It was only in the United States. You look at other parts of the world, especially Japan, and that market didn't know about it, but it wasn't very much affected by it. Because, believe it or not, in 1983, that's when Nintendo released their system, their first system in Japan called the Famicom, what we would later know here as a Nintendo Entertainment System. And it took off. It took off in Japan. And there was never like a down period of the video game industry over there. And what Nintendo was actually able to do was kind of look over the pond, look over the Pacific Ocean at the United States, and learn from the mistakes that Atari and Mattel and all these other game companies had made in the United States, and to ensure that another crash like that wouldn't happen. So I just wanted you guys to kind of look at that perspective too. Like, we know about it here, and it was a big event, and even in the stock market here in the United States and for the game companies here in the United States, it was a big deal. But in other places of the world, it wasn't a factor. So it's interesting to think about, especially for an event that was big in a certain industry like the video game industry. So for that reason, I've actually think that the game crash, good things came out of it, because who knows what the video game industry would look like now if the crash had never happened. You know, maybe Nintendo would have made those same mistakes. Maybe they would have created a game crash of their own in Japan. Maybe Intellivision and Atari would still be around. They'd have, you know, the Atari, I don't know, you know, they like going by their numbers, 2600, 5200. Maybe it'd be like on the Atari 32,000 now. I don't know. But, you know, it's a possibility, a very real possibility that they could still be alive and well as a business and as a console maker. So it's very interesting what different ways the video game industry could have gotten if not for that one event. But one thing is for sure, the crash provided many lessons to the companies of today. Things like quality control, limitations on how many systems can be at the market at one time, and not to put all your apples in one video game, because it can come back to bite you, just like it bit Atari when they put all their money behind Pac-Man, when they put all their money behind E.T., and then they had nothing to show for it. So the video game market today definitely owes a lot to that game crash and to those companies that went through that. You know, and it's funny now how I was talking earlier that people are paying these huge prices for the PS5, for the Xbox Series X. When back in 1983, it looked like video gaming was just a fad and there was going to be no more. It's funny how things change and turn out. And, you know, I think for the better. Looking now, the video game market has never been as strong as it is today. These consoles and these companies are making lots of profit. People are enjoying the video games they're getting to play, whether it's on the consoles, on the PCs, on their phones. That's another kind of butterfly effect there. Who knows if there's games, video games on cell phones, if the game crash becomes a long-term event and there's no more games. So there's a lot of kind of different pathways that the game market could have gone. As I get ready to sign off here, I want to remind everyone that you guys can always go on to Instagram, visit our page, Retro Nostalgia Podcast, to get the latest information on upcoming episodes, promotions, and guests that I have here on the show. So give us a follow there so you can always stay up to date. And until next time, my name is Matthew. And remember, the Retro Nostalgia Podcast is your number one go-to for all things 80s and retro video games. I'll see you guys next time.
You've been listening to the Retro Nostalgia Podcast. We release new episodes every Tuesday and Friday. If you like what you hear, please be sure to subscribe, rate, review, and follow us on Instagram. If you love it and you want to help support this podcast, consider becoming a Patreon member for access to exclusive content. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, be excellent to each other.